Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the appellants Mark Sen and Sam's Enterprise, LLC. Where the plaintiff's evidence does not conform to Minnesota law on damages, as the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated, it simply amounts to a failure on the plaintiff's part to prove an element of his cause of action, which, as the Minnesota Supreme Court says, are damages, and which the court said, quote, which of course would not be a grounds for granting him a new trial. A party who fails to meet their burden of establishing damages under the correct measure of damages is not entitled to a new trial as a remedy for the party's own failure. The law is unequivocal that a plaintiff is not given a second bite at the apple where he failed to meet his burden of proof at trial. Because a party cannot seek a Rule 5901 motion for a new trial under these circumstances, the trial court has no authority to grant him a new trial sua sponte. Rule 50.
Is there a specific case that stands for that proposition?
I've cited to the court, there's a case that I've cited that says that the court's authority is only in accord with Rule 5901, and Rule 5905 is explicit that, quote, the court upon its own initiative may order a new trial for any reason for which it might have granted a new trial on motion of a party. So if a party cannot make the motion under 5901, the court cannot somehow grant a motion for a new trial sua sponte.
I thought the respondent claimed that there was a basis for a new trial under, is it 5905D? I don't have the rules in front of me. Is there such a rule?
Well, it's 5905, but the rule says that it is only for any reason why you might grant a new trial to a party. So we go back to what could a party request here. And a party could not request a new trial because the party failed in to present damages in accord with Minnesota law.
So here's what I'm wondering, counsel. So we have the judge, I think, pretty clearly stating in the findings of fact that there were damages incurred by ARF. At least the finding of fact I'm looking at is number 5 on the addendum at page 14. So was damaged, but that the evidence that ARF offered wasn't the type of evidence.
Well, then there's no damage.
Well, so is that really your argument?
Well, that's...
I think it is. I think right. That is ultimately what you're saying, is that they failed in proof of an essential element. But the judge's findings do find damage.
Right.
It's just unable to determine the amount because the evidence offered didn't match up.
And it really doesn't matter because then you don't have damage because we're talking about compensable damage ultimately. So if you do not prove compensable damage, you haven't stated a cause of action and it has to be dismissed.
So that brings me to my next question because, again, now I'm looking at the last order that it was issued by the judge after the second trial. And in that trial, the judge actually does adopt a piece of evidence and accepts it as to the out-of-pocket lost income claim that was established. And that was offered during the first trial, but the judge didn't comment on it.
Well, in the first trial, actually, he rejected it because if he had accepted it, he would not have granted a new trial because then he would have been able, under his analysis, to award the $48,533. But as the judge says, the respondent's argument always was it was the cost to repair the $49,000. And that is in their proposed findings to the trial judge. So they were always arguing the cost to repair. What they tried to do in the first trial is through Mr. France's kind of a backdoor engineering to come up with some kind of number that would equate with the cost of repair. But ultimately, it never satisfied any such standard. And in fact, when appellant brought...
District Court agrees with you on that.
Pardon me?
The District Court agrees with you.
Right, so you can't go to the following trial and say, well, gee, now this is good, because it's not, and it never was good.
I guess I haven't reviewed the proposed findings by the plaintiff after the first trial, so you're telling me that they proposed in those findings...
The $49,000.
$49,000 as their, the cost of repair. What did they do with the lost income that had been offered?
Nothing.
No reference? Okay.
So, I mean, so what you have here is you have a situation where the court concludes that they did not prove compensable damage. A motion for, we bring a motion for amended findings saying you can't order a new trial here. The response by the respondent is, Judge, you're correct in ordering a new trial, and that in the new trial, now we're going to bring in this appraiser to give you the evidence you want. The argument was never made by the respondent in response that, gee, Judge, you were wrong, and you could have, you should have awarded us compensable damages based on the record that was presented in the first trial. So really, any kind of argument now is a shifting of theories. You'd have to file a cross review. So really, what we have here is a situation where in the first trial, the judge concluded there wasn't the evidence. The result of that is dismissal, not the grant of a new trial on damages. Now, this has ramifications going forward because now we move on to the punitive damage issue. Because the trial court was obligated to dismiss the intentional misrepresentation claim based on a failure of proof, therefore, it had no ability, and it would have no, actually, procedure to then entertain a motion to amend the complaint to add punitive damages. And because there was no compensatory damages, you can't have punitives where there's no compensatory and there was no intentional tort. So therefore, the motion or any motion to amend the complaint for punitive damages is also reversible error in any resulting award.
Well, it seems that the district court judge, having sat through the trial, was really appalled by the behavior of your clients and made findings to that effect.
And I agree, Your Honor, but I don't know, reviewing the record, why that is the case. I think that there was...
Well, counsel, I mean, the judge is pretty clear that there was fraud in the sale itself, that the representations not only weren't complete representations, but in fact represented the roof to be something that it wasn't.
And I disagree, because we have three different buildings, we have three roofs, there's absolutely...
But the judge did not adopt that. I mean, that's a really persuasive and compelling argument, but the judge didn't adopt that view of the evidence. Instead, he relied on the evidence by the man who did the most repairs, I'm forgetting his name, Weber, right?
Well,
But relied on his evidence to say that, well, water leaks.
But not in the roof over the respondent's units. And if you look at the conclusion of law of the judge says that there was fraud in the representation, that there was a good condition of the roof above the units, not with the other buildings. I mean, there are three separate buildings, and this isn't argument, this is fact. There are three separate buildings, three separate roofs.
But they're all apparently designed and constructed the same way.
That's true, Your Honor.
So are there some inferences that can be drawn from, if two roofs are leaking and they're designed and built with foam and they're flat?
Not when there's absolutely no evidence of any problems with the roof over the respondent's units, and also where you have the situation where they had the ability to inspect. They even admit they didn't really ask about any past leakage. They admit that the appellant did not say the roof was in good condition. I mean, so when you look at, I understand how the judge, the findings look, but when you review the record, and you look at the facts about the three different roofs and what was actually said and what the respondents say was actually said, I do not understand the trial court's ruling as to fraud, and certainly not to the point of somehow implicating punitive damages.
At some point, I thought the court referenced a negligent misrepresentation, but then it ended up being an intentional.
The negligent, in the first go-around, there was some statement in the conclusions which could border on negligent, but he found intentional.
I just have a question. I'm looking at the last pages of your addendum, and I understand about the three roofs, but then there's this RS1 that runs across the top side of it. What is that?
Let's see. The RS1, I believe, is, there was, and it's not stated here. I mean, there was actually like five roofs. There was kind of another overhang.
There's parapets. Or
yeah. Well, no, that's between.
That's between three, two, and four?
Right.
Okay.
Finally, the other thing that the trial court did is.
So we don't know what RS1 is?
I do not. I would have to go back and look at the report that goes with it.
So, counsel, with regard to your argument about the clear error in the judge's findings of intentional misrepresentation, you're saying that there is no evidence in the record showing leaks to the roof either over the units that were purchased by the plaintiffs here or over that, I think it's called the southern section, right?
Right. It was, there was after the sale that we had the leaks. There was some showing that there had been samples taken, is my recollection, but not any evidence presented of any leaks over that section. Okay. The other problem with the trial court's order was this conclusion of a breach of express warranty by Mr. Sen. There was no such claim pled against Mr. Sen. There was no assertion of a express warranty breach at trial.
You're saying it was only as to Sam's Enterprises.
That's correct. And where it shows up is the respondent put this in his proposed conclusions of law, and the trial court adopted it. But it does not correspond with the pleadings. It does not correspond with the evidence, and there's just simply no basis for any kind of breach of express warranty against Mr. Sen. In our brief, we also argue why legally there could not be such a claim here against Mr. Sen, and so that too must be reversed. So, what appellant is asking this court to do is reverse the judgment against the appellant because there is no basis to grant a new trial. So therefore, there was no basis to have what occurred with the new trial, and that there was no basis to ever have a conclusion of law of express warranty because none was asserted. So we ask for reversal.
And not remand.
Not remand, no reversal.
May it please the court, my name is Aaron Dean of Moss and Barnett. I represent the respondent, ARF LLC. And there's an old saying, you know, The third time is the charm, not in this case. We've had two trials. We had a very experienced trial judge. Judge Burke had been a trial judge for more than 30 years at the time of the first trial, obviously more than 30 years at the second trial. He made some very important findings about Mark Sen. And this case really comes down to one question, and one question only. It's something that we teach our children, and it's something that we live with as adults. Is there a consequence to lying?
Let me ask you this. What is the proper measure of damages for this wrong?
We provided a capitalization rate analysis.
I was going to ask you, is there any case law other than tax court cases that apply that as the...
I don't know about case law, but both the evidence at the trial, the first trial, was that Mr. Francis uses that when he is evaluating properties. It's similar to an income approach that the appraiser also validated in the second trial. And I want to talk about
those.
Well,
it is a recognized approach for determining market value.
Yes, for diminution of
value. In condemnation cases, it's used all the time.
It is. And Mr. Waitas in the second trial testified that not only is he an appraiser and a certified appraiser, but that he is also a real estate developer. So he owns his own property. He says, yes, I have read the more than 30 pages of testimony from Mr. Francis in the first trial. I understand why he used it. I agree with it. And he used a different approach. He used a standard diminution in value, which ended up being $45,000.
So do you think out-of-pocket loss is the measure of damages?
I don't think it really matters, and here's why. Diminution in value was $45,000. Capitalization rate was $48,533. Out-of-pocket loss is $49,000. They are within just a percentage or two of each other. And of course, with the appraisal that we had for the second trial, that cost $7,800 to get that testimony. And you'll see from the trial transcript in the second trial, Judge Burke commented on that, said, wait a second, that makes Mr. Waitas's testimony even more poignant and relevant. We had to pay for the $5,000 report in advance and his $2,800 appearance fee before we knew what he was even going to say. There was no attempt to influence the appraiser's testimony. And the appraiser, you know, discussed the fact that he verified and agreed with the capitalization rate testimony by John Francis in the first trial.
Did you present any fair market value evidence in the first trial?
Not in a traditional way like you would have with an appraiser. We used the capitalization rate analysis, which ended up being within a few thousand dollars.
Your client was the owner. The owner could testify to the value of his property.
And he testified about that through his capitalization rate analysis. So this is just, you know, this is how I view having all of the value of the property, how it was represented to me versus sold. And this blizzard of nitpicks that...
Well, before you call it a blizzard of nitpicks, counsel, I want to be clear that whether I'd like to hear your view on what your theory was after the first trial, because it sounds to me, and I haven't read the proposed findings of fact that you wrote, but what it sounds to me based on appellant's argument is that your proposed findings of fact asked the district court to award the cost of repair after the first trial, and the judge rejected that for legal reasons, obviously implied in some of the questioning that you had to answer today and fully briefed by both sides. So if your position after the first trial was different from what it is today, you know, are you allowed to change theories? And in the course of that changing of theories, you know, get a mulligan basically with the second trial.
Sorry for interrupting a couple times during the course.
Right ahead. Yeah, it was a long question. So
I don't think that there was that much thought put into it when we submitted the proposed findings, and here's why. We had a repair cost of $49,000. We had capitalization rate analysis of $48,500.
Did you include a reference to the capitalization analysis in your proposed findings?
I don't know if we did or not. I certainly had been, at the trial, and we had presented all the evidence. We were within a few hundred dollars on a property that had been purchased for $485,000. I mean, it's splitting hairs at that point. And I think what's really important is I go back and I look at some of the issues that have been raised. One of the, the issues that was really seized upon in the court's questioning was, is this one building or three building? It doesn't matter if it's one building, three buildings, or 100 buildings, and here's the reason why. It's very simple. There was one declaration. That declaration covered the entire property, all of it.
What do you mean by declaration?
The declaration that was recorded against the property for the condominium association, that declaration governed all of the rights and responsibilities of each unit owner. That declaration required each unit owner to be responsible for an adequate share of common expenses, such as replacing the roof. So it's just a strobe light, as a distraction, when the appellants say there wasn't leaking in over your unit, it was over this other unit, and they didn't disclose it. We had to pay. We had the obligation when we purchased those two units under the declaration, we would be responsible for that repair cost, even if it was over someone else's unit, because that's what the declaration said. The declaration defined the building as one building, not three buildings, is what they're saying today. That's hugely important.
So the roof was a common element, and every association member was...
Yes, and when Mark Sen lied, and that is the express findings throughout in the trial transcripts and in the two orders, when he lied to the judge was looking at him over the course of several days of testimony for both trials, the judge was correct to find a remedy. I've heard, you know, what's in the briefs I've seen about the standard of review, it's purely abuse of discretion. Did the district court abuse its discretion? And Chief Judge Cleary's order from September 18th, 2018, denying the petition for interlocutory review, even says that. It says these decisions are based and rooted in...
The judge has no discretion whether to follow the law. And if at the end of the first trial, you, as plaintiff, did not prove, offer evidence of all necessary elements of your claim, then you lost the first trial. You weren't entitled to a new trial. I think that's the argument the appellants are making, and I'd like to better understand your position.
Yeah, we respectfully disagree. We had all of the evidence.
Well, you didn't have all the evidence because you did not have evidence of the difference in the fair market value before, you know, with the representation versus with the lie, as you call it.
We did have that evidence. It was the capitalization rate analysis. We established our damages were $48,533. The district court didn't rely on that. He wanted to have a fresh look and have that evidence.
We relied on that to determine the amount of the damages even after the second trial. He noted it but he didn't rely on it. Well, I don't read it that way.
I'm sorry, Judge, for continuing to interrupt.
That's all right.
Should I go one here and wait? Here's what happened. If you look at the second order that the judge issued, he verified that whether you look at Waitis's testimony under a diminution in value as an appraiser or under the capitalization rate, either way, it works. Plaintiff wins, ARF wins, and Mark Sen loses. That's a key finding.
So I'm looking at Rule 5901, grounds for a new trial, and you obviously didn't ask for a new trial in your motion. He did it sua sponte. And so under which ground do you think he was entitled to a new trial to prove up damages?
The district court on its own has its own authority to determine whether a new trial is granted.
I know, but it has to go under one of those grounds in 01.
So we did not ask for a new trial. I think you could rely under 5901 G, right? If the district court was concerned about the evidence that had been received at that point, the district court on its own could order a new trial, because we certainly didn't move for it. And then by the time of the second trial, the district court validated the very testimony that had been received in the first trial after listening to Mr. Waitis. So the district court was well within its discretion, and that's the key point. It's an abuse of discretion standard of review.
This is my problem. So G says the verdict, decision, or report is not justified by the evidence or is contrary to the law. And so it seems to me that Judge Burke wanted to give your client damages or compensate your client for what he thought was Mr. Sen's lies.
If you look at the last paragraph, following paragraph G, it says, quote, "On a motion for a new trial and an action tried without a jury, the court may open the judgment if one has been entered."
But a judgment hadn't been entered.
Well, the court acted on its own before anyone could take any action. So the district court decided that it wanted additional evidence, even though we had already provided evidence, 48,533, which was just a hair away.
You hadn't just provided evidence, you had rested, right? I mean, you rested and submitted to the case for decision. I mean, it effectively let the district court reopen your evidence. It seems to me it's a very odd position for a neutral to be in, to suggest to the parties, I'm not satisfied with the evidence offered by the plaintiff. I want different evidence.
The district court found that we had been damaged, an express finding, and the district court has the authority to determine what it wants to do next when it is not sitting with a jury and it is making the decision. I think Judge Burke was being very cautious in how Judge Burke wanted to proceed, just to ensure that the evidence that had been received to date, he gave everyone an opportunity to present additional evidence. And what happened at that second trial? We presented evidence that showed 45,000 diminution in value, plus with the expert costs, we now have damages exceeding either repair costs or the capitalization rate analysis. And what was particularly telling, the appellants did nothing. They provided Mr. Mesner's testimony, who refused to present his own analysis. He provided a report review. He did not actually identify the value that he thought the property had been diminished. He conceded on cross-examination and on questioning by the court. There was damage. He just had no opinion what that damage was.
Have you ever been involved in litigation where after a trial, the judge, district court judge, has allowed the plaintiff to amend its complaint to add putative damages?
More than half of my practice, Judge, well more than half of my practice, is in arbitration pursuant to contractual arbitration clauses in larger construction cases. On the cases that are in litigation, I don't recall that happening, but I think it was within the district court's discretion for the reasons we've already explained in our brief. There was only a couple other points that I just wanted to make. One, there was...
Wait, so I'm clear. Are you saying that the trial judge was authorized to grant a new trial on damages without referencing to Rule 59?
I've never thought of it that way, but yes, the district court...
Well, it seems to me that's what we're arguing about. No. Appellant is saying, unless you can come under Rule 59, where you could have made a motion, the trial court on its own can make this motion, but Appellant is saying there was no basis where you could have made the motion, and therefore the trial court couldn't do it. That's what I'm reading out of this. So, follow me along here. Would you have had a basis to make that motion under Rule 59 for a new trial?
I suppose we could have, but we didn't need to because the district court already made its decision.
That's my question. Could you have? And if so, on what basis?
Could have in the future for events that didn't occur is a hard question to answer, Judge.
No, could have for the events that had occurred up to the point when Judge Burke made the motion for you, in effect.
I see that my time has expired. Can I briefly answer? Here's what I would say, Judge. There was no need for us to bring a motion because the court had already issued its ruling. It would have been an unnecessary act for us at that point to bring a motion, file the motion when the court had already acted.
Answer my question. So let's back it up 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever amount of time before Judge Burke made the motion, would you have been in a position to make that motion? And if so, on what basis?
I suppose we could have if we needed to, but we didn't think we needed to because we had provided the capitalization rate analysis.
On what basis?
If we
On what basis that fits the rule?
If we thought that there was a hole in the evidence, that there was, through cross-examination, if there was any question about whether we need an actual appraiser, and there didn't seem to be that at the actual trial. We had a very experienced commercial real estate person, John Francis, who testified. He uses the capitalization rate. He uses that in his business. We didn't need an appraiser. We had him to be able to offer that testimony. We ask for the result to be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nordhut?
Judge Klopach, in response to your earlier question to me about the court's authority with regard to a new trial, I cite to the court the case of Ginsburg versus Williams at 135 Northwest 2nd, 221, where the Supreme Court said that the trial court has no power to grant a new trial for a cause not enumerated in the rules. So the court has no authority sua sponte to grant anything that it could not grant for a party, and that's what the rules says. And further, to grant a new trial, the party must show that it has prejudice.
Could the trial court, instead of granting a new trial, have entertained a motion from the respondent to reopen the record to present some additional testimony on the question of difference in value?
It still would be, you couldn't do that, I do not believe, because
as you're saying, effectively, that would be a new trial on damages.
That'd be a new trial, and you can't do that. And also, I want to talk a little bit about what Mr. Francis testified to. Remember, he only testified in the first trial. He wasn't present in the second trial on damages. Now, on cross-examination, Francis admitted his analysis did not actually show the diminution in value of the ARF units, but rather purportedly measured the decrease in the income caused by the roof assessment. He didn't know the value of the units with the roof and the condition ARF claims it was in, and he further stated that he didn't know and he was not prepared to testify as to the fair market value. So there was never the testimony presented by Mr. Francis in the first trial as to fair market value. And that's why the respondent, in response to
our market analysis, is a way of testifying to fair market value, is it not?
It is not the way he presented it. It is not. It does not fit within the income approach. The court can read his testimony, and it doesn't fit. And the expert then they retained, which they could have retained for the first trial, says that he couldn't use the income approach because it's much too subjective.
Didn't want to?
He said he could not because it was too subjective. He did not use the income approach. So what you have in this case is you have a situation where the...
You're saying that the testimony from that witness was that he couldn't use the income approach as opposed to he didn't want to use the income approach because it was too subjective?
What he stated was that...
Every appraiser does that. Says, I didn't use that, I didn't use that, I didn't use that for whatever reason.
He said that in this case, any income approach to valuation was not reliable because the expenses and the capitalization rate would be too subjective to correlate. That's his testimony. And so he said that he could not use that approach. Now, the problem we have here is when the motion, we bring the motion saying you can't grant a new trial here, they don't say, well, you don't need to grant me a new trial. I've presented sufficient evidence. Actually, they say the opposite. They say, yes, now we can bring in an appraiser so we can establish what needs to be established for out-of-pocket loss. So if you look at their response to our motion, what you will see is an admission that the first trial, they did not meet their burden of proof. And there is no rule of the rules of civil procedure that allow for a party who does not meet their burden of proof to come back to the judge and say, grant me a new trial. It doesn't exist.
And so you're referring, you probably said it and missed it, you're referring to the motions that were filed after the judge issued his findings of facts, so those post-trial motions?
Right. So what happened was he issued his, what, in our proposed findings, we explained to the judge they didn't meet their burden of proof. The judge agrees and says, now I'm going to sui sponte grant a new trial. That leads to our motion seeking amended findings and dismissal because they didn't meet the burden of proof and you can't order a new trial here. To their response was, no, I mean, they don't assert the judge was wrong in granting the new trial, and instead they say, well, now we can bring in the expert to establish our damages. And that's what cannot be done. And that is reversible error, and I ask for dismissal of this case.
Thank you. The case has been submitted, and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days. The next case is Sarah Solomonson versus City of Austin, A19-1360. I think counsel are here, and we're going to have a switch out of judges.